Good morning, everyone. I'm Michelle Noyes, Head of Americas and for EMA, and I'm delighted to be moderating today's session on the business case for operating in the UK and best practices for market access. Thank you to the Waystone team for your support of this program. So I recognize it may be strange to have EMA's Head of Americas and a New Yorker talking about the UK, but this is really meant to be a practical resource for those outside the country to understand market access strategy and get the really practical information you would need to make a business plan. So I'll be putting myself in the shoes of our members outside the UK and asking the questions. I can also be a mouthpiece for your questions. So please do send in questions using the Q&A tab we have at the bottom of your screen. But we're lucky today to be joined by three experts, Robin Callender, Selma Coffey, and Claire Sim of Waystone to guide us today as we learn about the UK market. So let's get right into it. Rob, I'm going to start with you. And, you know, the first question that I always think is important to understand in sessions like this is really understanding the market and why a firm would want to set up in the UK. What is the business opportunity, the size, the fund structures offered, et cetera? So can you set the stage for us?
Absolutely. So I guess kind of despite post-Brexit fears of a kind of financial services exodus from London and increasing likelihood of regulatory divergence, the UK remains as a key market in global finance. So London remains as the world's second financial hub after New York. It's, you know, the world's highest net exporter of financial services. And London, obviously, with, you know, with its time zone, kind of vies with New York as world's financial capital. So I guess, you know, UK assets under management is north of, you know, $12 trillion with about $500 billion in the hedge fund sector. So, you know, packaged as the Edinburgh reforms through the government here, the aim of reforms within UK financial services sector was to support, you know, the government's ambition for the UK to be the world's most innovative and competitive financial centre. So these reforms allow the UK to take advantage of those freedoms from Brexit and build a smarter regulatory framework. So international fund groups, especially within the US, are at various stages of building their presence in the UK as they further expand the, you know, the investment proposition. And I think key to our discussion today, you know, another positive movement within the UK is the rise of alternatives, which is an asset class traditionally held outside regulated funds. However, with the inception of the new regulated long-term assets fund, so the LTAF, which can hold 100% of illiquid strategies within the portfolio, this is seen as an opportunity for private market specialists both within the UK and US. Obviously, there's a, you know, inflationary pressures, so investors could potentially benefit from leaning towards private markets for, you know, better future returns instead of the traditional 60-40 portfolio route. And again, UK domiciled authorised funds can be the fund vehicle of choice for asset managers wishing to grow their AUM through both institutional and retail investment. So we really see it as, you know, as a rise in the popularity of alternatives and really, you know, holding, you know, asset classes like private credit, private debt and everything as well for those managers looking to get exposed to the UK.
Awesome. I'm still remembering how to use the mute button properly. One would think years of this, I would be at it. You know, you did mention, I just wanted to dig in a little bit to that. You still see this increase of, you know, we'll just say US funds, but, you know, ex-UK funds coming to the UK post-Brexit, where there had been that real fear, you know, and you mentioned private credit. But do you have any just a little bit more anecdotal color on like the types of firms arriving? Are these expansions for firms that already have large footprints? You know, is there sort of a certain AUM trigger or, you know, strategy where this becomes really, really interesting? Robin, throwing this one back to you.
So yeah. So I would say you've got managers of various sizes basically coming across here. What I'm seeing is you've got the large institutional players as well, but you've also got the likes of hedge funds and family offices looking at those investment opportunities within the UK. So really it's very very broad, and I think the UK as a fund domicile may still be quite exotic, against the likes of your traditional Luxembourg and Irish funds that are there. But the opportunities that basically exist for those firms getting into those strategies as well as as an opportunity, especially with slightly depressed markets over here, and again obviously things like the exchange piece. So and it's very much on the piece in the UK to things like unlock pension money through the defined contribution market as well, where, as I mentioned earlier, you've got your 60-40 route that isn't maybe giving the sort of yield to investors. So getting into, as I say, these asset classes, especially the likes of real estate and infrastructure, meets the government's agenda in the UK and brings that potential foreign investment across the pond.
Well, you're setting it up very nice for your colleague Selma to weigh in to give us a little bit of an overview of why now and what are the opportunities, particularly as it relates to accessing UK pools of capital, which is always, I know, an important area of interest for our members.
Thanks, Michelle, and good morning, everyone. Thank you very much. Just by way of background, my name's Selma Coffey. I currently head up Waystone's, what they call MiFID distribution company, which essentially allows us to distribute across Europe. But from background, my focus is fully on distribution solutions. So hence why I'm here today. So just to go back to Michelle's comment, yeah, I think absolutely now, based on the types of structures we're seeing coming into the UK, this long-term asset fund or LTAF, as you'll hear it thrown around as an acronym, really opens up the market to alternatives. And the reason for that too is one of the largest allocator groups in the UK is pension schemes and insurers. And historically, because of constraints they had around, looking at a kind of a cost focus when it came to governance, liquidity management, where they were looking at daily dealing products and potentially not even insufficient scale for direct investments, having this new fund vehicle come in opens that market up to alternatives to come in. So I think at the moment that market's around 6%, and that would be across sort of specialized mandates, mainly focused actually, interestingly, on the kind of infrastructure element. And for infrastructure, where we're seeing there is very much it's split into kind of two pieces, if you like. You've kind of got what they call economic infrastructure, and that's your classic, your renewables, utilities, telecommunications, those kind of elements. And then there's a smaller element that I could see potentially growing over time, particularly looking at that worldwide drive around diversity and inclusion, which is on a social element. And that's looking at infrastructure around public health and education, and actually to an element to building, construction and maintenance, which we're ultimately going to feed back into those real estate markets. So I think really, as we're looking forward from now, and as these structures grow in popularity, you've actually got fairly unique, because it's looking at a UK domiciled fund within a very large market. Now, that said, for the pension side, as opposed to sophisticated investors who've been able to access these for a while, it still will take, I would say, some education, some working with them to grow and really understand their interests around the strategies. But really, yeah, I'd say, Michelle, that's where we're seeing the opportunity at the moment.
That's really interesting. So, again, this seems like it's a really seismic change and potential opportunity. Is that market heavily gate kept? I guess that would be the past tense, by investment consultants. Are there sort of kind of these conduits to these pools of capital that are really important to know if someone were to engage in this education and outreach?
So there is a consultant market in the UK as well, but really a lot of it can be direct access to the funds because they are quite big. But yeah, it would be a mix. It's not overseen by that. I think building your relationships with those allocators is relatively straightforward once you're in the market. But something that does need to be kind of considered, and Claire is going to come to this one later, is around the permissions that will allow you to build those relationships with those allocators.
And one other question for you, because I know, you know, one of the challenges we have in the US pension fund market is just how dispersed it is, right? We have a continental sized country. Each state has at least one, if not multiple, pension funds. I imagine if you're looking at the market in the UK, are you also going to be looking at the outside of London, or are most of the investment professionals sitting in London themselves?
I mean, you might have a small amount of canvassing, but yeah, on the whole, London tends to be the big focus when it comes to that kind of the portfolio and the investment management side of stuff, including access to allocators, which is why you find both kind of groups centered around London. Now, actually, interestingly, Edinburgh is in fact a kind of a second center, but it would tend to focus less on the portfolio management side. So some traveling, but probably not quite as extensive as coast to coast on the US.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, again, a lot of work to be done, but perhaps a little bit more efficient from a timing perspective. I was going to pivot over to Claire briefly and then come back to you, Selma, about, you know, you had mentioned that there are obligations to understand if you want to be operating in the UK. So Claire, can you tell us, okay, so if we agree that it's a good time to be in the UK, your peers are doing it, there's investors to talk to, you know, the business case is there, how difficult is it going to be to do this? What are we looking at, Claire?
So the actual authorization process, so getting FCA authorized in the UK, is a relatively straightforward process, you'll be pleased to hear. It's a form-based application process that is submitted directly to the FCA via its own portal, which is called the Connect system. And the different types of forms that firms have to complete depends on the nature of the activities that they want to conduct in the UK. So what the application, how the application is split, it's split into three sections. A section focusing on the entity itself that wants to get regulated. A section focusing on the individuals that are going to be involved in the operation of that business. And also a third part looking into the shareholders. Now, as part of the application process, there are two fundamentally important documents that need to be completed, one of which is your regulatory business plan, and the second one are your financial projections. These are key documents as part of any authorization process in the UK, regardless of what activities you're going to conduct. In regards to the business plan, this should include kind of the background to the firm, who are the owners, if it's part of the group, providing some details about the nature of the group and the activities that it's doing. Explaining to the FCA why the firm is being established in the UK and what authorizations it's seeking and what activities it wants to conduct. The FCA will really want to understand the governance structure. So as part of the plan, you need to identify your governing body, the composition of your senior management team, the roles that each of these individuals are going to be performing, and explaining their experience and their suitability to undertake this role and function in the UK. You need to explain the types of services that you're going to be providing, explain your marketing plan. And again, this goes back to some of Selma's points earlier in terms of how you're going to potentially distribute and get your customers. The idea is to, if you're managing portfolio funds, really explain in detail the strategy. Under AIFMD, there's a lot of information that is now required. So as much of articulating that as possible will make the whole application process clearer. Also explaining what you're not doing. This is also a very important part of the regulatory business plan, to make it incredibly clear to the FCA when they're reviewing your application and really understand exactly what activities you're going to be doing. And again, explaining kind of your longer term plans. In terms of financial projections, these are in a prescribed format. And you have to set, usually it's a 3-year projections on a month by month basis for the first year, and then on an annual basis for year 2 and 3. For those firms that are going down the MiFID route and they're going to be qualified as MiFID Pru investment firms, they will need to have what is called an ICARA, which is an individual capital and risk assessment, which also would need to be included as part of the projections. So when you're ready and you've got all of your documents ready and your filing done, you can put the application through the FCA system. You will pay a small fee, depending on the license that you're applying for, and then your application will get put into what is called the FCA's triage system. So this is effectively a sense check that is done by the FCA as to whether or not it is worth to continue with the authorization process. If it passes triage, your application is put into a queue, and then you're allocated a case officer within the FCA who's responsible for reviewing your application.
Can I jump in one second? This is excellent. I'm just curious about that triage step. Is that for folks that have put a decent amount of work into that, is that, do they usually pass triage? Do you have a sense of how many applications get stuck at that point?
That's a really good question. So the triage, if you have put the time into your business plan and filled your forms incorrectly, most firms will fly through the triage stage. We don't see a high proportion of firms falling at the triage stage. As I said, it's usually a relatively quick process. Once you've got through triage, it'll take you about 1 to 2 months, and then you'll be with a case officer where kind of your application will really be scrutinized. And then you'll enter into more formal dialogue with the FCA around your documentation that's been provided.
And then, you know, so once you've, presuming everything goes relatively smoothly, kind of what are we looking at number of months wise from beginning to end? Understanding, I'm sure there's variation depending on how many questions they have.
So the FCA, you can go back and forth with the FCA in terms of round of questions. 2 to 3 rounds of questions, even on a very well completed application form, is quite normal. In total, for a well-structured application with sufficient information and detail, the process is usually taking around the 6-month mark. Where there are gaps or where there are unknowns, that is where the process often gets extended, and we can find the FCA will come back with more questions until it is comfortable that it fully understands the business model, it fully understands the individuals that are going to be running that business, and how that firm will operate in the UK market.
Wonderful. And again, this is, you know, a concept in general. This pre-authorization is quite different than the process in the US. So something that, you know, at least American firms will have to understand as they go through this. And are there, you know, something that has come up, you know, historically quite a bit, are these regulatory hosted solutions and other sort of quicker ways to get to market while the fuller process is playing out? How has that evolved?
So that's a really good question. So for many years, as you correctly point out, an option that really offered a much faster route to market was the seeking appointment as what we call in the UK an appointed representative of an existing FCA regulated firm that has the permissions that you need. Now, in the UK, the appointed representative model has been subject to considerable regulatory scrutiny over the past few years. And this is as a result of some quite high profile failures involving firms that were operating as appointed representatives. So this has led the FCA subjecting applications who are putting to be an appointed representative to far greater scrutiny. And as a consequence, it now can take much longer to obtain that approval, typically around 3 months. So given it can take up to 6 months to obtain authorization, it might not now always be the most practical alternative because it's only going to be a couple of extra months to actually get full authorization. However, if you are dealing with a startup operation, there's uncertainty whether the business is going to get to a viable scale. Going down the appointed representative route, notwithstanding the time and costs that might be incurred, is still a very viable solution.
And that's actually a good segue back to Selma. You know, I'm curious, is there room for emerging managers to, you know, engage with UK onshore investors? Is there a really strong preference for just the biggest brands and longest track records? Can you help us understand a little bit of those preferences?
Sure, and Rob might jump in on this point as well. But really, I think the UK market, a little bit similar to the US, they're interested in strategies and managers that fit the profile that they're looking for. So it is as open to emerging as to larger. And you will have the allocators themselves would have a preference one way or the other is probably the best way to say it. But certainly, yes. I mean, you know, to feed back to Claire's point around that, looking at a hosting solution potentially, then rather than getting fully authorized, it's always worth looking at to, depending on whether you've got really strong contacts in the market and your, you know, your local, what they would call your authorized corporate director could help you out with what you do. Or in fact, maybe you've got a good third party marketer that might be able to test those waters for you. So there's a way you can slice and dice that to kind of look at it that way. And the other thing I think worth noting for the UK, but it will tie back to your plans for whichever vehicle you're going into the UK with, whether it's UK domiciled or whether it's going to be a US one, is to consider how much discussion you can actually have yourself without being regulated or under a regulated banner. And this would to do with typically there's a concept in Europe called pre-marketing, where you can talk about your fund while it's kind of going through its conceptual process to test the water. The UK doesn't have a formal version of that, but what it does have, it takes the position that if there's nothing there that an investor can commit to, there are some communications and conversations you may have with institutional investors to carry out that same testing. Now, you'd still need to be careful of a couple of things around regulation and communicating with investors, but it is often also worth considering that if you're still looking to just dip a toe in and you haven't made the full decision to come in yet.
That's quite helpful. You know, Claire, I didn't know if you had any other observations on this concept of pre-marketing, wearing your compliance hat, or if there were any sort of triggers to really stay away from.
Yeah, as you touched on earlier, in the UK, it's very important that you do not enter into regulated activity until you are fully authorised by the FCA and you have all the necessary approvals by the FCA. It's a very, very strict regime in that regard in the UK. So it's something that definitely something for firms to watch out for.
Okay. Talk to counsel for sure.
Exactly.
Robin, I didn't know if you had any other color on the emerging manager question and if you're seeing a kind of earlier stage managers come through your doors. Have they found success in this market?
Yeah, no, very much so. And again, going back to my earlier point here in respect of an education of the UK landscape, you know, an education of the, you know, the regulatory, you know, requirements as well. So, you know, very much a case of the UK model kind of fits all. And say there are quite a few US managers, you know, that we're speaking to in respect of, you know, the UK and opportunities there. And just to go back to that keyword, it's just an education really about, you know, what to expect. Some colleagues might disagree with me on this, but I very much see the UK as the gold standard in respect of regulation and requirements, you know, from the manager, you know, from the FCA's, the regulator in the UK's view of the authorised corporate director, as Selma mentioned as well, or the host AIFM. So the scrutiny that we can go through, you know, as a firm, and the delegation that we put to the, you know, to the portfolio manager themselves. So it's all, you know, all creatures great and small, to be perfectly honest. But as I say, with the opportunities and especially in this long-term assets fund that, you know, traditionally in the UK, it's all been fairly vanilla in the grand scheme of things, the allocations. But really getting into this private credit, private debt, real estate infrastructure isn't only a roadmap for the FCA, but the government as well, to get that, you know, foreign investment piece and unlocking pension money as well. So great opportunities we're seeing and a lot of inflow and inquiries from certainly US managers just now.
That's really helpful. And of course, LTAF has been a big strategic priority and part of AIMA's Alternative Credit Council advocacy on the private credit side. So for anyone looking at this who wants to learn more, please, we have a plethora of resources on our site, as you know, as does Robin and the Waystone team. So lots to learn. I'll also make another note that if anyone does have questions, if I'm not barging in enough with requests for clarifications and there's points that you want to hear more on, please do make use of that Q&A tab. And so moving on, a few other points. You know, Claire, you were telling us, okay, so there's the full authorization route. It requires, you know, really spending the time to think through a good business plan, which I'd argue probably something you should be doing anyway. So it's a helpful chat. You know, maybe for some, the regulatory hosted solution might offer a quicker route to market, but it doesn't have quite the same time savings as it has historically. But what should managers keep in mind when determining how to set up? And, you know, also, what are the mistakes that you see most common so that other people, like our members, can learn from their mistakes rather than having to make them themselves?
Yeah, good question, Michelle. So I know I've said it before, but the regulatory business plan is crucial. I think firms looking to try and fast track through and not invest the time in actually completing that document thoroughly will fall foul of the process and will find their application process being delayed. The FCA will not approve any application until it has all that information it needs. So one of the things that we always advise firms is make it as easy as possible for your case manager to review your application, where you can index the documentations, make sure links are very clear, really have sympathy for the person at the other end at the FCA that's going to be picking this application up and reviewing it. Another thing to really think about, and where we often see people fail in their process of leading up to the authorization, is thinking about the non-financial resources. So there's always a lot of focus on the capital side of things, but also actually the people and the systems are so critical to the success of operating and getting authorized in the UK. So when we're thinking of people, you've got to be able to demonstrate that individuals that you're going to put forward as a senior manager, we have a senior managers regime here in the UK, that those people have the right qualifications and the right experience to conduct regulated activity in the UK. A question we always get asked often by US managers that are established in the US and looking to come to the UK is, you know, how many people do we have to have on the ground in the UK as part of a senior management function? It's a very open-ended question, and it will be on a case-by-case basis. But the absolute minimum would always be two people on the ground in the UK. Ultimately, any firm has to satisfy the FCA that there are sufficient senior managers for the nature, scale and complexity of the business. So for anything other than the simplest of business, you would be looking at more than two people.
And Claire,
focus in the UK of mind and management, and that's something that the FCA will be looking for as part of the application process.
Yeah, no, and it's certainly a theme that we're seeing in their ongoing work with industry writ large. But back to the people point, what is the division? Are people moving, relocating folks over from their US office? Are they hiring locally? Is it a mix of the two? Are there any trends that you can distill on that front in terms of expat talents and local talent?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it does depend on the size of the entity. So we've got clients that we're supporting at the moment that are very large US managers. We're finding that they're hiring locally the kind of the compliance and the legal staff, but a lot of the IT, a lot of the operations, a lot of the investment managers are actually relocating from the US over to the UK. And that's a really strong message as well to send to the regulator, because these are individuals that are used to working in a regulated environment, albeit in the US, but they're approved by another competent authority. And that's something that the FCA really does give credit to and is looked upon favourably as part of the application process. But when it comes to things which are very UK specific, so your compliance, your legal, your regulatory frameworks, that's where we often see firms either bringing in local resource or engaging with firms such as ourselves to provide that local kind of on the ground technical knowledge and expertise.
Wonderful. So since I know I cut you off in the middle, just recapping, you know, the things that stood out to me, at least very bare minimum, two people really paying attention to these folks' qualifications so you can have a robust application, and then making it very easy for the examiner that you're going to be dealing with to make sure that application is clearly written and has all of the supporting materials, you know, visible and accessible. Correct?
Exactly. And to the extent if you're going to replicate your operating model or your IT framework that you've got existing in a different jurisdiction, again, provide as much detail as you can. And being able to demonstrate that it's been approved by a regulator in a different jurisdiction, and make it as easy for the FCA to kind of get their heads around it and to understand it and to ultimately approve it.
Wonderful. And Selma, back to you. You know, in this post-Brexit world, you know, there's members and managers in the US, for example, they look to the UK for the investors in the UK, but they're also looking at greater Europe some of those being EU investors, as well as jurisdictions like Switzerland. So how effective is the UK these days as a launching pad to access Europe writ large?
So it's actually still fairly effective, and particularly where you don't already have a European license. Historically, pre-Brexit, US managers would have moved into London, become licensed, and then they were able to use that license to market, have their teams market within the EU, and they'd apply similarly for Switzerland. So obviously nowadays they don't have that automatic transport to the EU, but the benefit with UK is you've still got access to that UK market as a regulated manager. Switzerland changed its regime a couple of years ago, so it's actually very straightforward there now to become what they call added to the client advisor register, so that actually individuals from US managers can find it fairly easy to become permitted to market a fund in Switzerland. And then within the EU, what you're seeing is really you're going to need to rely on a third party in one way or another, unless you wish to go for a MiFID license yourself, which can be quite costly. Unlike, I think, the FCA and the permissions there, really for MiFID, you could be, and this is purely on the distribution side rather than the investment side, you'd maybe be looking at 9 to 18 month time frame, and it could be between 500,000 to €1 million by the time you've looked at your licenses, put your substance on the ground there, because the EU does need substance as well. But that said, having English speakers in an English location that's a closer time zone to the US and only an hour difference to Europe can be quite useful, where a manager may already have contacts in Europe, whether that is direct contacts or whether they've got them through a third party distributor. So there are, it's still able to have a network that can reach out through Europe. I mean, we certainly support clients through, you know, we use our MiFID license as their distributor and allow them to keep the relationship. So there's things you can do as well like that with a halfway house. So I would say, is it as straightforward as it used to be post or pre-Brexit? Not quite, but it's still very accessible. And typically as well, what we see is that EU investors like EU domicile products. So the strength of being able to demonstrate you've got a well-regulated product in the UK, replicating that in Europe, and potentially it's going to be replicated in a Cayman shape as well, possibly a Delaware, is a really nice story to have for investors, that they can see you're looking across regulated areas like that. I mean, I think the one thing I would say, and maybe it feeds back really more to the UK market, but touches you as well, is on a practical basis. So in as much as you want to make sure the regulations are being adhered to and you've been set up and regulated, it's worth looking at how your allocators will come in to the product. Because historically, obviously, the LP or GP is going to have a very strong relationship, and that's where you're going to get your commitments from investors. But what the UK market was unusual in, and it was a leader in its time, was actually developing a number of distribution platforms as channels to bring in retail money through model portfolios that discretionary fund managers would run, and intermediaries, and obviously the pension funds and insurers. And roughly about 67% of the UK market comes through these platforms. But obviously that is mainly mutual funds, because that's what those schemes had access to at the time. What we're seeing now, and it ties back with Rob's opening remarks, and globally, this whole democratization where the industry is looking to allow access into private markets from individuals and companies that wouldn't historically have been able to come in before, is a rise in digital platform that can accommodate alternative investment funds. So I think it's worth, in as much as you look at the regulatory landscape coming in, have a think around the practical bits of what infrastructure does the fund need to have in place for those allocators to access as well. I think that's quite a key thing to remember as you're planning forward.
That's a really excellent point, Selma, and certainly it's been a transformational change for what we've been seeing in the alternative investment landscape, whether that's the US, Canada, and UK. So just if I'm hearing you correctly, those platforms, historically a preference for more liquid mutual fund, locally domiciled product, now open to alternative investments, but still that preference for locally domiciled product remains and endures. Is that correct versus a UCITS fund or a Cayman fund, for example?
It probably, UCITS now would be very popular. I think Cayman kind of gets caught into that alternatives space. But I think probably what I'd say is we're seeing that begin to shift. But if you look at how successful that way of accessing the market has been for mutual funds, I think we're going to see similar now on the alternative side. And a few of these platforms would actually go across the US, Europe, and are getting into the UK. So you actually may be able to build a relatively strong network for each of the vehicles you actually have, which could potentially be a game changer in terms of access to market.
No, that's an incredibly important point. Robin?
Yeah, okay. I mean, just to echo what Selma's saying there, you know, the platforms, the whole kind of bedrock of the kind of, the fund landscape, certainly within the UK, and I guess retail has basically given these investors a very, very straightforward means of getting invested into funds, even, with, modern technology and phones and everything that, people are basically kind of, subscribing into. And I think if we think about the long-term assets fund in the UK and what it is there to achieve, there are two points. The first thing is to basically get those alternative funds onto the list of approved funds within the pension landscape, and then I guess the second thing is just making sure that the funds themselves and the strategies can actually sit direct on a portfolio, but they can also sit as feeders into other strategies in other jurisdictions. So that there are options there. Platforms traditionally obviously wanted to look at direct strategies and portfolios, but we're seeing some feeders from an LTAF point of view going into other strategies that are run in other domiciles as well, and the platforms are accepting those. So it's an exciting time with options as well, in the UK piece, but the platforms is as I say, it's the kind of bedrock of the UK regulated fund space. And that's what's giving folk access pretty much straight away.
What's always struck me, in some of these conversations with you and your colleagues is, when you have these globally minded firms, it's the structures can get quite complex. So I imagine it's very important for them, as they're thinking through these business plans that are going to be, for their very important for the regulator, but just really thinking through writ large where they want to operate in the world, in which markets and which assets do they want to invest, and which types of investors and where they want to be able to raise capital, so that you can think through, really as streamlined and efficient a complex of vehicles and funds as possible.
I think the journey for managers is they'll have a roadmap. Some may be already exposed to Europe within, UCITS vehicles or private market strategies in other jurisdictions. Some, this might be completely new from being exposed to mutual funds in the US, right through to, deviating from that plan slightly in terms of getting into, the UK market. So And I go back to that point, it's just an education of the landscape, how they can grow assets, the means to grow those assets through the platforms, obviously, as Selma was talking about before. But it's just getting to grips on the blueprint and having an awareness of how they can access various different investors.
Wonderful. So as we look to wrap up here, I'll summarize sort of a few of the things that stood out to me and invite you if there's anything to add to do so. But, the movement is here. We're seeing more and more ex-UK firms look to domicile in the UK post-Brexit. There's new vehicles for them to do so, notably the long-term asset fund or LTAF. A big driver of this is the desire to access new pools of investor capital and be able to service them in a more fulsome way, given changing macroeconomic models that make alternatives more more attractive, as well as, you know, the increase in education from these investors to look towards alternatives. And these are notably the pension funds in the UK, the insurance companies, and then very interestingly, the platforms that serve the broader wealth and retail market. And then if you are saying, great, all of these things describe me, this is a market I would love to do, you know, Claire has summarized for us, you know, you should be ready to have a very fulsome business plan, looking at both your financials as well as how to staff this operation. You know, the regulator is going to be looking very carefully whether you have the right people and the right funding to do what you're saying to do to have, you know, this robust operations. And, you know, there's a few different routes to market, but perhaps the sort of going direct is more attractive than it used to be on a relative basis. So anything to add to that I've missed?
No, I just say, look, when it comes to a manager's distribution strategy, the concepts are going to be exactly the same as you have in the US. It's just asking the questions to see how that practical overlay is going to operate within the UK.
Wonderful. Well, with that, I would thank you for spending your time educating me and by proxy our members outside the UK about what it takes and why they might want to set up in the UK. For folks on the line who have questions who did not raise them, I would encourage you to follow up directly with Robin, Claire, and Selma to speak further. Of course, my AMA colleagues in London are also a tremendous resource, and we'd be very, very happy to help, as well as connect anyone who does set up with our really robust network of peer groups and events on the ground in London. So thank you all. Have a wonderful rest of your Friday, and have a good one.